Who is the most powerful person on earth? Who would you say? Who is the most powerful person on earth? There are four choices. Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. Option B, Barack Obama, the president of the United States. Option C, Xi Jinping, the general secretary of the Communist Party of China. Or option D, Pope Francis, the head of the Roman Catholic Church. Which one? Four options, A, B, C, and D. Who is the most powerful person on earth? Well, according to Forbes magazine, this is a giveaway, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, is in fact the most powerful person on earth, followed by Barack Obama, Xi Jinping, and Pope Francis, in the order that I've just given you. Vladimir Putin has the world in his hands, according to Forbes. And the senior editor of the magazine wrote this, as the undisputed, unpredictable, and unaccountable head of an energy-rich, nuclear-tipped state, no one would ever call him weak. You might be thinking to yourself, well, this bears no significance at all to me because there is no way I'm going to be like Vladimir Putin. I've no interest in politics, and I have no interest in becoming the world's most powerful person. Well, hang on there. Perhaps you might admire someone like Mark Zuckerberg. At only the age of 30, the CEO of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, is the youngest person on the list of the world's most powerful person, coming in at 22nd. You see, in the world that we live in, honor, power, and security are becoming the entities which govern our lives. It's all about elevating ourselves to a higher place in society. Many of us, we join the rat race and slave our lives away to reach the thrones, the throne of honor, the throne of power, and the throne of security. That is why, in today's passage from Mark chapter 10, verses 32 to 45, James and John made the most selfish request to Jesus. Let one of us sit at your right and the other on your left in your glory. James and John are filled with high aspirations and they are thinking big. They want to make it to the top of Forbes magazine's list of most powerful people in the world. Dare I say that there are many James and Johns in this church today, and myself included. Many of us want to be the most powerful people in our own little lives. We want to be the king of our own little world. It's fine if I don't make it to the Forbes magazine's list, but I want to be the king. I want to be the king of my family. I want to be the king of my workplaces. And I want to be the king of my church. I'm embarrassed reading this passage, and the way Jesus replied, James and John, made me feel even more embarrassed. Jesus asked, "What do you want me to do for you? What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus, being the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, turned around and asked, "What do you want me to do for you?" And this is in stark contrast to the request of James and John, isn't it? Jesus, do this for me. Jesus, give me this. And Jesus, give me that. Well, in order for us to understand this passage even better, allow me to journey with you, beginning from verse 32. Verses 32 to 34 tells us that Jesus and his disciples were on their way up to Jerusalem. You see, he wasn't going to Jerusalem for a mere visit. This wasn't his annual pilgrimage. This was a journey of Jesus to his death. Jesus was leading the way, and he was literally, as well as figuratively, leading the way. Jesus was literally leading the way in that he was physically leading his disciples to Jerusalem. Figuratively, Jesus was leading the way in which his disciples must walk in the future. Jesus had previously predicted his death twice, once in chapter 8, verse 31, and for a second time in chapter 9, verse 31. Now for the third time, Jesus, being a good teacher, repeats the same teaching material to his students again. Now with a little bit more detail, with the hope that they would eventually understand. Verse 32, again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. "We are going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death, and they will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." Jesus predicts that he will be rejected, leading to a series of betrayal from Judas to the chief priest, and from chief priests to the Gentiles and to the Roman soldiers who will eventually carry out the execution. You see, after all that Jesus has said, and after all that he has taught, James and John came to Jesus and asked him the most unbelievable question. Verse 35, "Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. 'Teacher,' they said, 'we want you to do for us whatever we ask.' And Jesus said, 'What do you want me to do for you?' They replied, 'Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory.'" I know that there are a few teachers here in this congregation by profession, and imagine that you have been conducting lessons to a bunch of students, which include James and John. And I want to put to you that James and John are probably the most difficult students to teach in your classes. You have taught them the same lessons 3 times, and they still haven't got it. You have poured in your heart and soul into teaching them, but it felt like they have turned a deaf ear and they have blinded themselves to your teaching. They have done the same to Jesus. And it is hard to believe that these two brothers could have come up with their ambitious and selfish request. Yes, the disciples knew that Jesus' time was short. Yes, they knew that Jesus' kingdom was near. And that was probably all that they understood. But with the little that they understood, they were very quick to take advantage of it. My wife loves watching a show called Air Crash Investigation. It is a series of documentaries about plane crashes throughout the last few decades. In one of the episodes, it was revealed that moments before a plane was about to dive into its fatal crash, passengers were frantically getting their pens and papers out and writing down notes. And they were hoping that these notes, if they were to die, these notes would be found and be read by their loved ones. You see, when death is near, it causes people to do the most important things and make plans for the future. Usually, it is also very revealing of what their heart is. For the disciples who knew that Jesus' death was near, you could clearly tell what was dear and what was important to them. They started off with a blanket request: "We want you to do for us whatever we ask. Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." Why? Why were they arguing about who occupies these positions on Jesus' left or right? Why is it so important? These are positions of thrones. These are positions of power. And these are positions of authority. They were feeding their appetite for self-indulgence, self-interest. They knew that Jesus' death is coming, but they misunderstood what it all meant. They thought that Jesus was coming as a conqueror to overthrow the current Roman kingdom. That's probably why they were clearly trying to secure their own positions and standing. James and John, as I said before, they were extremely quick in making advanced reservations. And allow me to introduce to you a colloquial Singaporean English word called kiasu. See, kiasu. Kiasu originates from a vernacular Chinese word and it's found its way into the Oxford English Dictionary as well. And according to the Oxford Dictionary, it means a grasping, selfish attitude. A grasping, selfish attitude. As an adjective, kiasu is used to describe a person who is very anxious about losing. In recent years, I have learned of an alternative use of tissue paper in Singapore. If you, and I'm not too sure how true this is, but if you pay a visit to Singapore, you will find packets of tissue paper lying around on food courts, especially during lunchtime peak hours. These packets of tissue paper are not found by chance, apparently. They are not left on the tables because someone has forgotten to take them home. These are calculated, deliberate move by individuals who have decided to use these packets of tissue paper as weapons to claim food court tables. You see, this phenomenon of making seat reservations is not a new one. And for some of you may like to think that James and John had long ago pioneered this tradition of seat reservations. If James and John could write a book, you could perhaps call it The Ultimate Guide to Being Kiasu. Or if James and John could write a book in English, it could be called The Ultimate Guide to Having a grasping, selfish attitude. James and John were not interested in ordinary seats in food courts, you see. They knew that the moment of Jesus' triumph is near, and they immediately revealed their interest in securing the highest seats in this new kingdom. It was a worldly ambition that motivated them. And what's interesting is that this isn't the first time that they were engaging in their own status and greatness. If you could recall in chapter 8, verses 33 to 35, the disciples were arguing about who was the greatest, to which Jesus replied, "If anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all." Remember that? This time, Jesus said, verse 38, "You don't know what you are asking. Can you drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with. But to sit at my right or my left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." The cup is an Old Testament symbol for suffering, especially for enduring the wrath of God. If you read the later part of the Gospel of Mark in chapter 14, verse 36, Jesus explicitly used the word cup in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he said, "Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup. Take this suffering from me." Baptism is also an Old Testament picture of undergoing the wrath of God. Although the New Testament concept of baptism into Christ is rich, it is always, always baptism into his death, as you could read in Romans chapter 6, verse 3. So both the cup and the baptism, they are both symbols of the cost of following Christ. And if you find this concept difficult to understand, we could also have a look at the words of the Apostle Paul in Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 to 11, and I'll let you read this in your own time. In this passage, Paul, the Apostle Paul, wrote that in order for Jesus to be in glory and seated at the right hand, which is a position of importance, the right hand of the Father, he has to go through death, submission to the Father's will, sacrifice, and humility. And all of that was captured in the concept of the drinking of my cup, drinking of the cup I drink, because That was the taking in of all of God's wrath. It was the drinking of all of God's wrath that was meant for somebody else. This was a cup full of the world's venom, evil, and sin. It contained everything that God was angry at and punishable. And yet Jesus was going to drink it and swallow it for us. And did James and John understand this? Well, clearly not. Clearly not. Their answer, "We can," was reckless and thoughtless. They had no idea what they were saying. Jesus warned them that suffering would indeed come and all must endure it. But it would not necessarily lead to high places in the kingdom of heaven. The right and left places of glory were for God alone to give. Even Jesus, the Son of God, was in loving submission to his Father. So it is entirely up to God to dispense such honor at his will. Verse 41. When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Why? Why were they indignant? Because they felt defeated by the other two who had gone ahead of them. James and John were too quick. They too wanted to make reservations for those high places of honor and glory. And of course, you could imagine a stir of anger amongst them. So what did Jesus do? Verses 42 to 45. Jesus called them together and said, You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. These few verses are probably the most important in this entire passage. So if I've lost you, and if you've fallen asleep halfway through, listen up. Jesus knew that James and John and all the disciples were interested in their positions of power, their status, and authority that comes along. They wanted to be great, even among God's people. And from that position of power, they intend to boss people around. Their understanding of greatness was similar to that of the rulers of the Gentiles and their high officials who exercise authority and lord over people. So Jesus rebuked his disciples by giving them a drastic 180-degree turn to what their understanding of greatness is. Not so with you. Not so with you. The pattern of God's kingdom is totally, completely different. True greatness is humble service. As Ken has mentioned previously in this morning's presiding, true greatness is humble service. Jesus himself is the greatest example of this. And as prophesied in Isaiah chapter 53, Jesus came to be the suffering servant of God and give his life as a ransom for many. And I'll read to you from Isaiah chapter 53, verses 4 to 5. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we were healed. And that was how Jesus' death saved us. His death became a ransom for us. And if you're familiar with the word ransom, it means the price paid for the release of a captive from a hijacker or a kidnapper. In those days, it was the price paid to liberate a slave, a prisoner of war, or a condemned person. And to set a person free like this is known as redemption. that price paid for our redemption was in fact the life of Jesus. The Apostle Paul wrote in his letter in Colossians chapter 1, verses 13 to 14, and he wrote this, "For he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins." So Jesus liberated us from the kingdom of Satan and brought us into his own house, the kingdom of the Son. Our release from Satan's prison was purchased by the life of Jesus. I find this passage greatly disturbing, and I find the words of Jesus very unpalatable and difficult to digest, because the more I read and understand this passage, the more I see myself in the shoes of James and John. For in fact, the picture of James and John is a reflection of many of us. While some of us are outwardly obvious in our desires for seats of power, most of us may not be outrightly demonstrating our demands for such power. But by much more subtle behaviors, we too show how little we grasp what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. So today we have been presented with two different choices, and we need to choose. We need to choose between James and John or Jesus, between the sons of Zebedee or the Son of Man. James and John were self-seeking, and Jesus was self-sacrificial. James and John wanted power and authority. Jesus showed humility and service. James and John wanted lordship. Jesus wanted servanthood. James and John wanted security. Jesus came to suffer. James and John wanted greatness in the eyes of man, and Jesus showed us greatness in the eyes of God. So it is so important that you know which choice you have made, because these two cannot be merged. These are two lifestyle choices that reflect our prayer life. Do you pray like James and John in verse 35? "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." Or do you pray like Jesus in verse 45? "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." James and John taught us how to pray the world's worst prayer, a prayer that centers on I, me, and myself. Jesus, on the other hand, taught us how to pray a true prayer, a prayer that reflects our total surrender to God's will. So I hope that I'm able to show you how this passage can apply to all of us, to various groups in this church, to parents, to students and young professionals, to the older generation in this church, as well as church leaders. We'll start off with parents. So for the parents in this church, I want to draw your attention to a very similar passage in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 20, verses 20 to 28. This in this passage in Matthew's Gospel, it tells us a very similar story to the passage that we've just read. And it reads, "Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. 'What is it that you want?' Jesus asked. 'Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom.'" So you see, although this part is not recorded in the Gospel of Mark, what we find in Matthew's Gospel is that the mother of James and John had an active role to play. She got her hands dirty, and she was actively seeking for her son's greatness. So parents, Do we want our children to know Jesus and live for Jesus? Or do we want to live our lives through them so that they may become great high achievers who draw praises that you can take credit for because you are the ones, you are the parents who raise them up? For the students and the young professionals in this church, I know that you love to drink Coca-Cola because it is delicious and it's refreshing and it quenches your thirst. Well, the man behind this mega company is Roberto Gozueta. This was the man who built the Coca-Cola empire in the 80s and 90s, becoming the CEO in 1981. And by the time he died in 1997, Roberto Gozueta was worth $1 billion, and he has transformed Coca-Cola into one of the world's most successful and admired companies. Under his leadership, Coca-Cola's stock price jumped 3,500%, and the company tripled in size and controlled nearly half of the world's soft drink market. It's impressive, isn't it? Friends, most of you are in the prime time of your career. You are either studying in one of the world's best universities or working your way up the corporate ladder. And perhaps you are working yourself up towards this, becoming a great person. You see, there is nothing wrong in being successful in your own personal careers, but we need to ask ourselves, what is your motivation? What is your ambition? Do we find ourselves like James and John, praying for our achievements, praying for our success, fame, status, recognition, glory, and prestige? Well, is this what we are living for? Well, what about this man? So this is a bibliography of John Stott. John was born into a very privileged family, and his father was a physician. John Stott instead focused his life to service to God as well as people. At the age of 20, he wrote this letter to his father. "I am going to throw myself, body and soul, into the struggle for right. My desire is to see the world a better place, and I will not spare myself." And guess what? He didn't. He became the rector of All Souls Church, Langham Place, London, at the age of 29. He gave his life up into following the footsteps of Jesus and became known internationally, of course, for his writing and for his preaching. It was no surprise, therefore, in 2005, that he was named by Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential people on earth. In one of his sermons, John Stott said this: "Young people, you guys, you have the whole of your lives before you, 40, 50, 60 years of service. How are you going to spend it? You want to be stretched in your service to Christ, but why? Is it to minister to your own vanity, your own ambition, or your own hunger for power? Or do you want to find a sphere where you can stretch your gifts so that you may serve God and the human race? How wonderful if all the young people here today are to determine from today on that I am going to give my life in service to God." So I put to you that we need to make a choice: a life of service to your own ambition or a life of service to God. To the older group in this church, I have to say that it is very tempting to become more and more like James and John the older we get. As life experience increases, as seniority increases, as position of power increases, there is the increasing tendency for us to exercise lordship. And we see this in families where parents lord over their children, where parents-in-law lord over their sons and daughters-in-law. And similarly, we can fight for our partner's life to evolve and revolve around us, always seeking to change him or change her. Not surprisingly, of course, marriages can break down when someone craves for power within a relationship. We also see this in workplaces. And I have been told of a story of a senior medical doctor in Malaysia who exercises extreme authority over his patients. And apparently it is not an uncommon practice for senior figures in the hospitals to behave as kings in the hospital. It is either my way or a highway, and if you do not listen to me, you can leave. Ironically, this doctor was also an elder of a church. To the church leaders, do you sometimes find yourselves acting like James and John? If you teach in Sunday school or lead Bible studies, are you doing it because you enjoy the status associated with leading? Or are you doing it for the Lord? And when you are up here leading the congregation in singing praises to the Lord, or if you're up here playing musical instruments, do you indulge in the attention that you are getting, or are you doing it for the Lord? For those of you who serve in areas of leadership on the stage, are you secretly lusting for that sense of superiority? Standing here, I too am very vulnerable to such temptation. The pulpit is actually a very dangerous place for those of us in the church who choose to follow in the footsteps of James and John. It can become a place for you to feed on your addiction for power, status, and admiration. So remember that we are not to exercise lordship, but leadership. And leadership, as defined by Jesus, is service and servanthood. Jesus did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as the ransom for many. If anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all. For everyone here today, can I encourage all of us to reflect on all areas of our day-to-day lives, at a personal level, as well as corporately as a church? We are standing at a crossroad. One road leads to greatness in the eyes of men, and this road is infected by a syndrome that I like to call the look-at-me syndrome. Look at how great I am. The other road leads to greatness in the eyes of God. And we cannot travel both roads at the same time. We need to make a choice. And the choice is between two completely different value systems and two completely different lifestyles. It is my prayer that you and I choose to follow the road of Jesus and the way of the cross.